Ooh, hi, my name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And that was really awesome. I mean, that was unbelievable. I just want to welcome the newcomer and and all of the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous, all of you. I am so grateful that you guys did the countdown before I spoke, because there's something about having a countdown prior to speaking. It just builds up the energy level, and for me, it's like the best thing that could ever happen for me when I'm speaking. Follow a countdown. First, I want to thank the committee for extending to me this most loving invitation to be of service tonight. This is it's really a privilege. I'm one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous who was taught that I would never, ever be able to repay this program for what it's given me, ever. And I believe that. There's no way I could stay sober 100 years and I would not be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I was taught is that I should always try. And whenever I'm invited to be of service in this program, unless I absolutely cannot be present, I say yes. Whether it's cleaning up after a meeting, emptying ashtrays even though I don't even smoke, picking up chairs even if it's not my chair, answering a 12-step call, leading a meeting, it doesn't matter what it is. And it doesn't matter how inconvenient it may appear. When I'm invited to be of service, I say yes, unless I just can't do it. So I want to really thank all of you for inviting me to be here this weekend. And I really do want to say welcome to those of you that are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you don't have a clue what's in store. You really don't. And I say that endearingly. You know, I say that from the bottom of my heart, and I say that with love. You just don't have a clue. Talk a little louder. You guys can't hear me in the back? Is this better? Okay. Thank you. I have to say, when we were just doing the countdown, while it's really wonderful for me to see the very new people in this program, personally, with 14 years of sobriety, I'm especially grateful to see the people that have more time than me, because I know what it's like to be a newcomer, but I don't know what it's like to be over 14 years sober. And I pray to God a day at a time that I get to be 15 and 20 and 35 and 47. You know, I pray that I last that long and I stay sober that long that I get to be like you guys. So while I welcome all the newcomers, I am really, I hold my heart out to those of you that have come before me and that keep showing up and show me that that it works by example. Through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and very, very strong sponsorship, I have not had a drink or a drug since July 26th, 1979. And and for that, I'm most grateful. You know, I stand before you tonight a living example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you. But more than that, I stand before you as an example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can show you how to do in your own life. My story is really simple. It's a story of hope and inspiration for anybody that wants to be inspired. If you want an excuse not to identify with me, I must say, you can find that. I'm black, and I don't see that many black people sitting in this audience. So if you want a reason to identify out, there's one for you. About half of this room consists of men, so if you'd like another reason to not identify with anything I have to say, there you go again. And I'm 40 years old, so if you're either younger or older than 40, then you'll find yet another reason to say, well, you know, I'm different. But I can tell you, if you want a reason to connect with my insides, if you want a reason to connect with my heartstrings and my feelings, you'll find plenty this evening, plenty, because my story is about hope and inspiration. It's about how Alcoholics Anonymous picked me up out of the gutter, found me as a drunken woman whore, and taught me how to first not to drink and use drugs a day at a time. And then, through the 12 steps, it taught me how to become the kind of woman that I never even wanted to be. You know? You know, very often people say to me, Francine, you have the perfect woman story. You know, and I suspect usually they say that because I am a woman. But the reality is my story is a people story. It is. And I've had more often than not men come up to me and say, wow, you know, I connect with that. You know, I felt just like you felt. And, you know, that's the real gift of this program, to be able to connect with other people and know that we're not alone and to have role models on this journey through life. And today I stand before you a woman that walks with dignity, a woman that holds her head up high. I go anywhere today, anywhere. And that's what you've given me. You've taught me how to be that kind of woman. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, 40 years ago. And I like saying that from the podium. I just need to let you know. I grew up in a time in the 50s and the 60s when women over 30 were put out to pasture, but quick. And I grew up, while my mother never said this to me, everybody around me, you know, you open up magazines and you see young women, you see women that are 105 that didn't necessarily look like me. And so I grew up believing that anybody over 30, any woman, was not vital and not worth anything. You know, her days were numbered. And that sort of thinking plays heavy on young girls as we grow up into womanhood. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found unbelievable role models that have shown me by example that that the older we get, the better we get, if we do the work in this program, that we can become vital, healthy, whole human beings. And so I stand before you, and this is what 40 looks like today, you know? This is what 40 looks like. And sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and I didn't feel this way 40 years ago, I can assure you. You know, I guess if I had to pick one word pretty much that described how I felt as a little girl growing up in the South, it was probably pained. I was a kid that always hurt. It was as though I felt like I just wanted to unzip my skin and step right out, because I always hurt. I always felt different, and it was always as though there were a party going on somewhere, and I wanted to be a part of the party and didn't know how to do it. I just didn't know how to fit. There was a television movie about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was called Separate But Equal. It was about our former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's attempt to get some piece of legislation, some case into law. And in this TV movie, they were trying to understand the impact of segregation on small children. And they had this little control group. They had little black kids, and they gave them four little dolls to choose from. They asked them a battery of questions, and they asked them to choose from these dolls. And one kid after another, when they asked them to pick out the ugly doll, picked out the doll that looked just like them. The little black boys picked out the little black boy dolls, and the little black girls picked out the little black girl dolls. And you know, when I saw that movie, I had been sober a number of years, but it was as though it had taken me back to many, many years ago when I was a little kid. Because you see, I knew what that felt like. I knew what it felt like to feel ugly and feel less than because of what I look like. And on some level, that I carried with me for most of my years until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and was taught differently. For most of my life, I was always looking at this image of myself in the mirror and hating it and wanting desperately to be someone different, desperately. And eventually, I believe my drinking and using was an attempt to erase how I felt about who I was as a little kid. If there was anybody looking at me as a very small child when I was growing up, they realized how much pain I was in. And if they really were attuned to what was going on, they knew that at some point I was going to find some way to make the pain go away. Some way. I mean, it didn't matter how it was, but my body and my mind were in such a state that I needed to be out of myself. And they knew that I was going to find something to make that pain disappear. And for me, my earliest escape in life was literature and the silver screen. I loved movies, and I loved old books. I loved old movies, and I loved books. My mother was a librarian, and we used to have lots and lots of books around the house. And as a kid, I really couldn't read very well, But I would manage to take a book off the shelf and just kind of glean through what was going on. And I could piece together enough to know that when I started to read, I was in another place. It took me to like a never-never land. When I started to read, I became pretty, I became smart, I became someone different than this little kid who I was. And it was the same with old movies. I loved old movies. I loved women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. I loved women that had a glass in one hand and they had a cigarette in the other hand. You know, and they didn't take a lot of crap off anybody. And I needed that because I was this little kid with this huge hole in my gut and I just needed something to make that pain go away. You know, and it's interesting, as I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hear men talk about their role models being guys like George Raft and Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne and, you know, Jimmy Cagney. And I understood that because I needed someone tough, tougher than me, that I could emulate. And it really blows me away today when I think about it because I learned a lot about who I was as a woman years ago from watching women like Betty Davis. I learned how to hold my cigarette when I used to smoke with my little pinky stuck out, and I'd hold my glass with my pinky stuck out, and I'd look at myself in the mirror as I watched Betty Davis, and I'd strut. You know, I learned how to do that walk, and I learned a lot about who I was from watching those women, you know. When you're a little kid and you're really coming from an unhealthy place, some role model is better than none. And it took many, many years until... It took many, many years after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for me to start developing new role models, and the role models were you. But at that stage of the game, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford were it for me. And it worked for a long time. The books and the movies managed to take me away to a place that that was warm and comfortable and safe until they just stopped working. And it was about the age of 14 when instead of taking me away from the pain of growing up in my own reality, this little kid who was in a lot of pain, what started to happen is at 14, I started to recognize that where I was really not where I wanted to be, and the books and the movies didn't make the pain go away anymore. Instead of taking me out of the reality of growing up in the South Bronx with huge rats and eating plaster off the wall, what started to happen for me as a kid at 14 years old was I became very painfully aware that who I was this little black kid growing up in the South and eventually the South Bronx, and that was my life, period. There was nothing else in store for me. I could dream all I wanted, but this was my life. This was the hand I was dealt. And while I don't believe on a conscious level I said to myself, you know, I'm going to then go out and use drugs and alcohol, I do believe on some subconscious level that the pain was so great, I needed to find something that was more effective, that was quicker than the books and the movies, and I found it in chemicals. From the age of 14 until the age of 26, when I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was not a day that went by that I had a sober breath. There was just not one day that went by. For 14 years... or for 12, from the age of 12 14 to 26, every day was a nightmare. You know, I remember when I first got sober, I used to talk about the really good times, and I believed that what I had experienced out there was good. I had gone to the right places, I saw a lot of things, I traveled. And yet, when I first came in, I didn't want to tell you about the things I did the morning after and how I felt as a person, how I felt as a woman. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I found it very, very difficult to talk about where I had come from because I thought that where I had been was so bad and so horrendous that you guys wouldn't let me in here. And I can only say that I'm grateful that I stuck around long enough to experience the love that you eventually gave me. But when I was out there drinking, there was no love, and I was pathetic. Alcohol and drugs took me to places that I would have never, ever gone to, ever, had I not been drunk or wasted. I became the kind of woman alcoholic that was vile and that was wretched. Every single day of my life, I was a woman who compromised herself to the point that I no longer realized what I was doing was a compromise. I found myself doing things that I know my mother never trained me to do. You know, today in Alcoholics Anonymous, I enjoy a wonderful relationship with my mother, and I'm able to look back on all the good things that she taught me. She taught me how to be respectful. She taught me how to be a lady. But somewhere along the line, once I picked up my first chemical, all the things my mother taught me sort of blew out the window. You know, I forgot what it was like to behave appropriately. Because when I picked up a drink, the drink took me. And it took me to places that I never, ever would have gone to. I'm a believer, as I stand here tonight, that had I known what was in store for me, short of Alcoholics Anonymous, had AA never been invented and had it never come into my life, had I known what was in store for me for the next 12 years, I would have never picked up my first drink or drug. I can just tell you for myself, I would have never done it. Instead, I would have done what so many young people do today. I would have found a way to cut the lights out. My mother would have probably come home one day after work and found me hanging from a noose in my bedroom. Because you see, the place I went, the places I went, no animal should have ever had to go. No human being should have ever had to experience the things I experienced as an alcoholic woman on a day-to-day basis. I found myself knowing what that dark place was all the time. You know, when I first came into this program, I remember reading in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous the line, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And you see, the first time I read those words in chapter 3, it was almost as though those words jumped off the page and grabbed me around the neck. You see, I knew what that was like. I knew what it felt like to feel pitiful and incomprehensibly demoralized. I knew what that was like as a woman. Every day I was in that position. Every day I allowed myself to be in that position. I knew what that dark place was about. I knew what it felt like to live the kind of life that I vowed I would never, ever share with another human being. I knew what that was like. And yet every day the drink put me in a position where I did things that I hated myself for. There were times when I'd come home doing whatever it was I felt the need to do in the streets of New York. And I'd take showers, and I'd just scrub my body. I would just scrub and scrub, trying to get that dirt off my body. And for those of you that are real alcoholics, you know the kind of dirt I was trying to take off was not that surface dirt. Not the kind that if you put a little soap and water on, it removes itself. Or if you put a little fragrance, you no longer smell it or see it. The kind of dirt that I kept trying to scrub off my body was that dirt that was attached to the inside. The kind that says if you lie down with scum, that's what you become. The kind that says no amount of soap and water is going to make you feel clean as long as you continue to behave the way you're behaving. And that's how it was for me every day of my life as a woman alcoholic. In 1978, I knew that clearly something was wrong with the way I was living, and yet, for the life of me, I didn't realize it was booze. You know, there's a wonderful pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe it was written for someone like me, and it's called Denial, The Merry-Go-Round of Denial, because that's how I came in here. For the life of me, I didn't believe that what had happened to me in the years I was out there had anything to do with alcohol. You see, I believe that you guys were the problem. I was a victim. Poor me. I mean, of course, I was black. I was a girl. And I believed that you caused this, that I just happened to be there and I was a victim of circumstance and those guys made me take money. I believe those people forced me to do all the things they forced me to do. It wasn't my fault. You know, I was just innocent. I just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And so in 1978, when I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, my brain was full of denial. I came in here through the insistence of a therapist, and I might say for myself that anything I share from this podium is my own experience. It's what I have found personally has worked for me. It's been my own experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I have, everything I am, everything I feel, I've gotten through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get it through therapy. I didn't get it through other programs. The fact that I behave differently today is because I work this program. However, it was a therapist that brought me into the rooms. It was a therapist who said to me that I had an allergy to alcohol. Now, If you tell an alcoholic of my type, steeped in denial, that they have an allergy to alcohol, they did, and I did, what I thought any self-respecting alcoholic would do. And I ran out and I got this allergy test. Now, you know, and it's kind of funny if you think about it, but it's sick, really, if you think about it, because all that does is suggest to you how much denial I was actually in. You know, she said I had an allergy, and one would think, any right-thinking person, that that meant you had a problem with booze. But as most of us know, alcoholics are not right-thinking people. And I went out and got this allergy test, and it had they gave me a needle. It was a big head with four little needles, and they prick you to see if you're allergic to anything. And clearly I wasn't. I wasn't allergic to anything. If anything, I was allergic to my bad attitude and bad behavior, you know. But that didn't seem to be enough to stop me, because you see, I was a woman on a mission. And the mission was self-destruction, my own. You know, today I think back on that woman. I think back about that woman who crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous 14 years ago, and sometimes I'm really sad when I think about her, because, you know, while I was out there, I thought I was really hip, slick, and cool. Nobody could tell me anything. I thought I was a grown-up, you know. I was the first to tell you that I knew how to take care of my life. And yet, if you looked at me, there was no way in the world I knew how to take care of my life. There was no way in the world. By the time I came in here in by the time I got sober in 1979, I was really ready to be here. But it took a year prior to that, you know, for me to first be introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 78, I would come to meetings at the insistence of this therapist, and I'd sit and I'd take inventory, and I would drink in between. I'd drink in between. And, you know, I know that you guys knew that I was drinking. I know you knew. But not once did you tell me I couldn't come into the meetings. Not once did you say, Francine, we are not going to allow you in here because you're drinking and we can tell. And that's one of the reasons why, for me, it is so important to just say to anybody that's in this audience tonight who happens to be drinking or using drugs, it's okay. It is okay. You know, if that's what you need to do for today, it's fine. We are glad you're here. Since the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, I am so grateful you're here. Because, you see, if you are lucky, like me, the seed will be planted. Perhaps not tonight, maybe not next year, maybe not in 5 years. But when I was ready, I knew where to go, because you didn't tell me I couldn't come. I might also say to those of you that are in here and you might be drinking, if you think we don't know, think again. We know. You know, I used to drink, at the very end, I drank vodka, and perhaps some of you were as much in denial as I was. I believe that vodka could not be smelled, you know. Well, those of you that are laughing obviously know that's not true, you know. And it would be oozing out of every single pore, and I just knew nobody knew I was drinking. Well, let me tell you guys, if you are in here drinking, we do know it, but we want you here anyway. We are so glad you're here, and just keep coming back. Just keep coming back, you know. Thank you. In 78, I kept coming back, and it took me 9 months from the time I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, it took a year. It took 2 years for me to make a year. I was first introduced to this program in the summer of 78, and I got sober in the summer of 79. I moved out to Las Vegas in November of 1978 looking for that pot of gold. I was always one of those people who thought that if I physically removed myself from what I thought was the problem, that the problem would disappear. And see, I believed that if I left New York and moved to Vegas, the problem was gone, because you see, New York was the problem. New York was definitely my problem. And I believed that, and so I hightailed it on out to Nevada. And the sad reality is that the problem followed me, as most of you know. The problem was with me. And one of my dear friends in Washington, D.C., Hal Marley, says to me, Francine, when you look in the mirror, you are looking at the problem. But I didn't understand that at the time, and I figured if I physically moved from here to there, it would disappear. But it took about 9 months before some sense got beaten into me. I drank and used for 9 months living in Nevada. And for those of you that have been there, you know it's an easy place to drink. It is so easy to drink and get wasted because booze is practically free, you know. And then in June of 1979, I got hit by a car in a blackout. And I can tell you, as I stand here, I don't even remember what happened. I am so totally incapable of separating fact from fancy at this stage that I don't have a clue. The last thing I recall was I was sitting in a discotheque in Las Vegas, Nevada that no longer exists, called the Brewery. And the following morning, how appropriate, huh? The following morning, I came to in Desert Springs Hospital, and my entire body was in a cast. And my body was in traction, and my leg was in a cast. And they said to me they didn't understand. They didn't think I was going to live when they first found me in the streets. They found me on Paradise Road in a direction completely opposite from where I lived. And they didn't think I was going to live when they found me there. And when they realized I was going to live, they never thought I'd ever walk again. Because my left leg had come right, it was up behind my head, and the bone had come straight through. And today I walk around with a very, very unattractive scar on my leg. It's a nice 10-inch scar with lots of hardware lines. And I've often been asked if I would consider cosmetic surgery because it's so unattractive. And I can only say for myself, for today, I choose not to cover it up. Because you see, it becomes increasingly easy to forget where I've come from. I'm sober a long time today. My life is so totally different, it is unbelievable. And it's easy to say, well, I don't need to go to so many meetings. It becomes easy to say, because I'm sober such a long time, I can kind of forget about doing service. It's easy to forget a lot of things when you get sober in this program, unless you work hard at remembering it. And one of the reasons I choose to keep this scar on my leg is because every single time I look at it, I'm reminded of the price I had to pay to stand before you even this evening. The price I had to pay was high. I had to pay with my blood, I paid with my sweat, and I paid with my tears. Alcoholism took everything away from me, literally everything that was dear and near to me. It took away the use of a leg for a year. It took away the family that loved me as a child. It took away what few friends I had left by the time I came into this program. It took away every single material thing I had eventually amassed over the years due to my drinking. But more than that, it dug deep down inside of me and took away the last vestige of my self-respect. It took it all away from me. And so one of the reasons I keep my leg as it is today is because I don't ever want to forget the price that I had to pay. In 1979, one would have thought with a car accident like that, that would have been enough to get me sober. And the reality is, for those of you that are real deal alcoholics, you know that no mere car accident is enough to stop a woman on a mission. You know? And it's really kind of sad because I almost didn't make it here tonight, you know. Because had I continued to drink and use, I wouldn't be here to tell my story. But I suspect the God that I didn't believe in at the time wanted me around for some reason. And, you know, sometimes I even question that. I wonder why I've had to go through the things I've had to go through in my recovery, why my road has seemed a little bit more difficult than others, why I even had to live the kind of life I led when I was drinking and using. And someone that I love very much says to me quite simply, Francine, it's for service. She said to me, you know, everything you've gone through in and out of sobriety, you've been able to share with someone else and let them know that you can stay sober regardless. Every single thing I've experienced in my life. And maybe that's the reason I keep going through that stuff. Maybe that's why I had to go all the way down the scale as a woman alcoholic so that I could share with other women and perhaps men that had to go to that same place, that same dark place. Perhaps the reason I experience all the things I experience in sobriety is so that someone could be given just a little bit more hope, someone who perhaps thought they couldn't get through another day having gone through some of the things we experience in life. But today I do believe that whatever it is, I'm most grateful for the opportunity to show up for myself on any given day. Any given day. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1979, I'd like to tell you that I came in and I embraced this program with open arms. I'd like to tell you that I was the perfect little AA, that I did exactly what was told, and I sort of rode off into the Alcoholics Anonymous sunset. But the reality is I had a very bad attitude. I had the same bad attitude I had when I was out there. You know? And it makes sense. You know, how could you one day be drinking and next day not be drinking and expect to be different? I wasn't. I was the same person I had been the day before. The problem was, had I not been willing to do any work to change, I probably wouldn't be standing here tonight. Because I was told that the woman who crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous would drink again. And you see, I do believe that today. It took almost 2 years and almost losing my recovery for me to get to that place where I became willing to surrender to this program. At 2 years, I came in with a real cocky, bad attitude, and I hung out on the side of the room with the people who said, honey, all you have to do is come in and take up a seat, and you'll get this thing through osmosis. Well, I didn't even know what osmosis meant, but when I found out, it was like music to my ears. I mean, basically, for those of you who don't know, it simply means you don't have to do anything. You just kind of sit back and rub up against someone who has, and you'll get it, you know? And I like that notion. I like the fact that I didn't have to do any work. I like just hanging out, you know, taking up a seat. Well, I have to tell you, the sponsor that I eventually got didn't believe that. She's one of those real tough cookies in Las Vegas. Her name is Louise R. And Louise was a believer that if you want what we have, you do what we do. It's that simple. She said to me, Francine, over and over and over again, it's not a mistake that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an entire chapter called Into Action. And she said, more than that, it's not a mistake that in that chapter, you will find most of the 12 steps discussed. And she said, even furthermore, in that chapter, you're going to find the promises. She said, if you want the promises as we extend them to you, then you must get into action. She said, by no means do you have to do anything, however. And she was really clear on that up front. She said, you don't have to go to meetings. You don't have to do service. You don't have to do any work in this program if you don't want to. But she said, if you continue to do what you've been doing, you will continue to get what you've been getting. It's that simple. She said, no one will ever tell you you must behave differently. She said, but if you keep behaving the way you've been behaving, your results will be the same. And that was really tough for me to hear because, you see, I didn't know how to behave differently. I came in acting like a whore, sounding like a whore, dressing like a whore. And she was a woman who consistently said, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, if you behave like a whore, you'll be treated like one. She said, if every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, then that's how people will respond to you. She said, if you continue to walk into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with hot pants and see-through blouses, then don't be surprised that you get accosted, you know. She said, don't be surprised if some of the women don't want to talk to you and that all the men will want to talk to you, you know. She said, you get what you put out, you know. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. That was such a foreign notion to me. Because, you see, my self-esteem had always come from something external. Always. And it had always generally come from men. It had come from men. It had come from baubles. Because, you see, by the end of my drinking, I had long since seen poverty. I found a way out of the poverty. I lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I wore diamonds and furs. I frequented all the right places. There was never a paucity of some rich man in my life who was willing to take care of me. I was very well kept by the end of my drinking. And I believed that I didn't have to do anything for that. I believed that this was just given to me. The reality is the price I had to pay was very high. It was self-esteem and dignity every single day. And so when I came in here and she started talking about self-esteem coming from doing esteemable acts, that was a biggie for me. Because I didn't know anything other than selling my soul. I didn't know anything other than flaunting my sex and expecting responses. She taught me how to behave differently. She said, the steps are to help you. But you must be willing to do the work to make the changes happen. And a day at a time, I stand before you as a very different woman. A very different woman. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I walk with dignity today. I can spell it, and I can define it.
All right.
You know, I'm a woman that walks... Today I am self-supporting through my own contributions. You know, it's a big thing. If you've come from where I've come from, that's a big, big thing. At 2 years sobriety, I couldn't stand the way I was living. I couldn't stand who I was. I couldn't stand anything about my life. I was living in Vegas. I was making an awful lot of money, I might add. I was one of the first women dice dealers in a major strip hotel, and so I was doing fairly well. But something was missing. Something was missing. And that something was that inside, you know? The real self-esteem, that inside was missing. And so at 2 years sobriety, I decided I wanted to go back to school to pursue a career that was going to require about 10 years of a commitment. And I could tell you I could not spell commitment, and neither could I define it, you know? Because, you see, education had never been important to me. I didn't have to be educated. All I had to do was look okay, and I got what I wanted. I never had to be educated. And as a result, I never was. I played hooky from school when I was in high school. Then I dropped out. It wasn't important. But at 2 years sobriety, it became important. Because, again, it was wrapped up in that self-esteem. Self-esteem coming from doing esteemable acts. And for me, going back to school a day at a time was an esteemable act. Especially coming from the place I came from where I could barely read. I mean, even though I had read as a child, somewhere along the line, I honestly believed, because of all the chemicals I used, my brain just was fried. I couldn't put a coherent sentence together when I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so ashamed when you guys would give me the traditions to read, instead of asking you to help me pronounce certain words like anonymity, I would throw them back at you and storm out of the room like a malcontent because I was too ashamed to say, help me pronounce this word. I was too ashamed to ask you to help me, too prideful. A day at a time, I asked for lots of help today. You've taught me how to do that. But at 2 years sobriety, I started to study. I wanted to pursue this career. The only problem was I was a dropout. You know, so how was I going to get from A to C? My sponsor said you get from A to C by doing the footwork. Just like you do on your recovery. A day at a time, you do what was necessary. And so I bought this GED book, and I used to hide it underneath my bed when company would come because I was too ashamed to tell you guys I was a dropout. You see, I was a liar, too. And I don't even believe most of you believed me when I lied and said I had some college. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter until that point in time when it started to matter. Because I didn't want to live a lie anymore. I really didn't. And so I'd study the book, and then I got into college in Nevada. In 1981, I went to UNLV. I started the university. And I started on this road to get this degree that I wanted. And, you know, most people in Vegas laughed at me. Most people thought I was really crazy. And today I understand that it wasn't for malice. It wasn't because they were mean. It was because they didn't want me to be hurt. You know, it's really tough when you come from where I've come from and you start talking about doing big things. You know, and people that love you don't want to see you hurt. And so it was easier for most of them to say, Francine, why don't you try something easier? Why don't you try something that won't require so much education? Something that if you fail, you won't feel so devastated. You know, but I didn't want to do something else. And I have to also say, I understand those people could only pass on to me what they had. You know, if you come from a fearful place, you can't pass on courage. And many of them were themselves afraid to take risks in their lives. So they couldn't say to me, Francine, go for it, you know, because that's not what they had inside. But I had a sponsor, thank God, who was really tough and really strong and really grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, she consistently said to me, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, Francine, you could have anything you want in recovery if you're willing to work for it. She said, the sky's the limit. The sky is the limit, but you must be willing to do the footwork. Now, maybe she didn't really believe I could do it, but she acted as if, and I followed her lead. And I worked my way through school. I moved back to New York in 1982, and I worked full-time. I went to school full-time, and I was active in service, as I have been since I was 3 months in this program. And I stress that I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day because all too often I hear the newcomers between those delicate years of 1 and 5, the ones that start to flex their little AA muscles and they start to go back to school, they get in the right relationship, or they have the right job, and all of a sudden nobody's got time to go to meetings. And I hear it. Over and over and over again, I hear not only those that go out and drink, but I hear the disease of those that don't, that sit in the rooms, miserable, full of resentment, full of anger, full of fear, because they've forgotten what their primary purpose was. And so I had a sponsor, thank God, who consistently reminded me that it was about staying close to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I didn't, I might lose this precious gift. And she reminded me that the only way I was able to be in school was because I was sober. You know, that's why I was in school, because I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1986, I graduated from college and I moved down to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And in 1989, I moved back to New York, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can... Thank you. That belongs to you as much as it does me. There's no way in the world I would have been able to get to the point of going to law school and then getting through law school had it not been for you guys. But in 1989, I moved back to New York, and, you know, I'd like to tell you that after I graduated from Georgetown, that I sort of rode off on this wonderful cloud and everything was perfect, got this great job on Wall Street, and my life just was right on. You know, I'd love to tell you that, but there are enough of you in here that know my story. It's been a struggle. And I suspect it's been a struggle because I'm one of those people that's wanted everything. You see, I wanted it all because you told me I could have it all. Perhaps if I wanted a little less, then I wouldn't have had to deal with so many obstacles in recovery. But because I wanted it all, I've had to fight for it. And I don't regret it, because while the road was difficult, the gifts have been innumerable. On my 10th anniversary, when I got out of law school, I sat for the New York bar. On my 10th anniversary, I held my 10-year chip in my left hand, and I wrote the exam with my right. And I went in prepared, and I failed the test. The worst thing that could have happened to me at that point was that I should fail the bar and not be able to find employment. And that's what happened. And I was devastated. I was devastated. At 10 years sobriety, I had worked so hard to get to that place, I couldn't believe I failed the test. And it took every single thing that I had received through Alcoholics Anonymous for the 10 years before that to get me to the place where I became willing to sit for the test for the second time. And I failed it again. And I'm going to tell you, it doesn't get easier failing test in recovery. The only difference is that today in sobriety, I know that I get up and I, with your help and God's help, I dust myself off and I start all over again. I cry and I scream, but I do it again. And eventually I passed the New York bar and I was admitted to the bar a couple of years ago. Thank you. And then you guys said to me again, you could have anything you want if you're willing to do the footwork. You didn't let me stop there. You said you can have something else if you want. And I decided, and I hadn't even made a decision to move at the time, I decided I was going to sit for another bar exam just because one day I might want to move. You know, I wasn't ready to leave New York at the time. But I didn't want to be sitting for a bar exam either. And I knew I wasn't going to want to live in New York all my life or the rest of it. I took the California bar the first time, and I failed it. And I'm going to tell you, this is almost becoming a pattern with me. And I can tell you, I sat for the California bar two more times, and I did not pass. I took it the last time in February, and right before I left and moved from New York to California, the day before, I got the news that I failed the exam again. And it really floored me because I was so prepared for that exam. It was unbelievable. And I still, to date, can't figure out a reason why I failed. I can't. Other than that it has to be a spiritual answer. You know, the God that I've come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, for some reason or another, wanted me to reach out in L.A., and perhaps I might not have done that had I gone in with a job and gone in having passed the test. Perhaps I would not have been so willing to open myself up to a new family had everything been intact. I don't know. I'm going to sit for the exam again in February, and I can tell you that I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. Just like I don't want to stand up here and tell you the things I just told you. But a day at a time, I become willing to do the footwork. And the footwork means different things at different times for me. Part of what it is for me today is a willingness to let you see who I am inside. You know, I was the kind of person who used to laugh at people who failed exams and didn't get things they wanted. You know, I used to laugh at people like that. Today, I'm one of those people who's in the game herself. Today, I am in the game, and I know what it's like to have to struggle. And instead of laughing at people who don't make it the first or the tenth time, I celebrate their courage, because that's what I've been given today, too. You know, it's really easy when everything's handed to you to feel grateful and to feel wonderful. I learned that in this program. When everything's going smoothly, the easiest thing in the world is to feel okay. It's not so easy when you don't get everything you want and you have to struggle and you have to get up and show up again to make it happen. Today I'm full of gratitude. I'm a woman that's an active participant in the creation of her own life. I stand before you tall today. I stand before you with my heart open and my insides. I let you know who I am. I take the risk to be honest. I take the risk that some of you won't like who I am. But I take the risk that some of you will. I take the risk to let you see my insides. Mostly I share my story for those of you that perhaps somewhere in your recovery you've had a little desire, maybe a tiny glimmer in the back of your mind that you wanted to do something, but you've been afraid because it's easier not to try. It's easier to sit back and take inventory rather than to get out there and try something you've always wanted to do. It's easier to say, well, I didn't really want to do that anyway, you know. And I sort of feel like that right now about the California bar. I'd like to say, well, I don't really want to be a lawyer in California anyway. But the fact is I do. Fact is I do want to be able to practice law in the state of California, whether I ever do it or not. I want the option. I want the choice, which means I sit for that test again in February. And for those of you that maybe have a dream, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a dream. But for those of you that maybe have a glimmer of a dream, my story is about hope. It's about suggesting to you that even if you do fail the first time around, that if you get up and dust yourself off and start all over again, you'll get there. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. But Alcoholics Anonymous gives us the tools to make our lives exactly what we want them to be. Exactly. I am so grateful today that the gifts that I receive every single day of my life, I recognize. You know, when I was newly sober, I remember being asked to make a list of all the gifts I wanted out of sobriety. And on that list, you would have found literally every single material thing that I lost. Excuse me, plus stereos and this and that and fur coats, all kinds of things, all the baubles that I lost due to drinking and using. You would have never, ever found on that list the real gifts that I've received, those intangibles, the things you cannot touch, the things like courage, the things like discipline, the things like self-love, the things like a faith that works under all conditions, the things like family and friends. Those are the real gifts you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes, I've gotten material things because I've worked for them. It's that simple. I've worked for them. But the real gifts have been the intangibles. The things that make it possible for me to stand up before a crowd of people that I don't know and share my insides. Courage. That's a gift. The thing that allows me to prepare for this test again in February. Courage. Discipline. That's what you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to share also, before I end, something else that really has been one of the most special gifts. There are two other special gifts. One is the gift of love, and the other is the gift of a faith that works under all conditions. When I came into this program, I was what I consider an agnostic. For those of you that don't know the difference between an atheist and an agnostic, an agnostic simply believes that there's some kind of God out there, but just not for us, not for me. I believe that people who talked about God, I believe there was a God for them, but not for me. You see, the God of my childhood had been the God of hellfire and brimstone, and God knows I didn't want a part of that. It was that old man sitting atop a mountain with a long beard mandating what I should be doing. Whenever they said the G word in a meeting, I just cringed. It was like just too much for me to bear. But a day at a time, my sponsor kept saying again, you know, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And action was the key. And in the beginning, she suggested that I just act as if. She told me that my prayer should be something as simple as, in the morning when I woke up, to ask this thing to give me the courage to not pick up a drink, to not pick up a drug, and for me, because of how I had lived my life, not to compromise myself as a woman. And she said, if I found at the end of the day that I didn't drink, that I didn't use a drug, and I did not compromise myself for that 24-hour period, she said, just say thank you. And that's how it started for me. I would say that every day. And she also had me read in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, pages 86 to 88. They have two prayers, one when we retire at night and the other on awakening. And I would just read them. And I found one day that I wasn't acting as if anymore. I found that the day came when I really started to believe in this power. And today I can tell you that I'm one of those people that the 11th step talks about, who would no more do without food, air, or sunshine than I would a faith that works. God has become an integral part of my life. God has become for me the greatest gift of my sobriety. It's only been through that faith that I've been able to stay sober for 14 years, that I've been able to, with God's help, change the woman who crawled in here, that I've been able to put myself through school, that I've been able to sit for exam after exam when I didn't want to, that I've been able to do a lot of the things that I haven't wanted to do. It's that God that's taught me how to open up my heart to people regardless of the color of their skin or their religion or their background. It's that faith that works under all conditions that's taught me how to love. For me, the love started through animals. I might say this, that there are perhaps some of you that are too new to appreciate what I'm about to share, and maybe some of you are too sober. I first learned about love through animals. When I got sober, I had two cats. And they were very dear to me, and they were with me during my drinking, and they were with me during my recovery. And I suspect had they been able to leave when I was drinking, they would have left. Because I was a very neglectful parent. I was abusive. And I'm often grateful today that I didn't have children when I was drinking, because my kids would have been scarred for life. They would have been scarred. But instead, God gave me animals to first learn about love, and last year, I had to put one of my cats to sleep after 16 years, and it was the most painful day of my sobriety. It was more painful than failing every single bar exam I failed. It was devastating for me. This animal of 16 years I held in my hand as it died. And I just knew I was never going to get another cat. I had one at home, and I said, this is enough. I mean, how awful it is to give your heart to something or someone and then it abandon you. It's like people dying. But you see, you've changed me sufficiently in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've opened up my heart. And instead of going out getting one more cat, I went out and I got two more. And typically alcoholic. And now I have a house with three little animals running around. And we all moved to L.A. together about 2.5 months ago. And it's awesome. I learned how to love through animals. And then I was able to pass it on to people. You know, a day at a time, my heart is open. You know, sometimes I go into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in different parts of the country, and I realize that we bring into meetings what we've learned outside, and there's lots of prejudice sometimes in meetings, you know, because of someone's skin and their religion, and sometimes even because of the part of the country that you live in. You know, and a day at a time, for me, that's not who I am. If you look at my coterie of friends, it's international, because that's what you've taught me. You've taught me that love doesn't have a color, doesn't have a religion, you know. It's just when your heart's open, it's there. Thank you for giving me that. Thank you for making me the kind of woman today that I respect, that I like. Thank you so much for my sobriety. In closing, I would like to read something from AA-approved literature for those of you that are AA purists. I am a believer that the answers are in the books. I got sober through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, and I believe that every answer I will ever need I find in the literature. I mean, I've proven it. Every time I thought it could be disproved, I've proven it. And my most favorite book next to the 12 and 12 is As Bill Sees It. My sponsor gave me this initially because I was so full of anger all the time. She suggested to me that I read everything on anger, because in the beginning it has a little index according to name, to words. And then she said, after you read everything on anger and resentment, read everything on faith and gratitude. She suckered me into reading this book, you know. And now it's my most favorite, and I'd like to end with this. It's on page 4, and it's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And you've given me that. You've given me the gift of choice. You've told me that it doesn't matter where I've come from. Doesn't matter what my past was. Doesn't matter what part of the country I grew up in. Doesn't matter what color my skin is. Doesn't matter whether I have hair or don't have hair. You know, doesn't matter whether I believe in God or I don't believe in God. Doesn't matter where I've come from. You've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time that the only thing that matters is where I'm going. And you've provided me with 12 steps of recovery to make that road just a little more rich and a little more wonderful. Thank you.